Hasan Minhaj, ladies and gentlemen. Hasan Minhaj.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Hey, man. So we didn't know each other. Our mutual friend, Roberto Villalobos, he told me, he's one of the editors for my podcast. And he said, he goes, look, I know you and I know you would love this guy.
Okay.
So he got us together. Uh-huh. And just like in high school, I waited till the last minute to cram for this.
Okay.
And last night, I was looking you up online and I looked at your website. Your website is fantastic.
Oh, thanks, man.
My website, when I made it, and the thing that I always have in my mind is I wanted to entertain the shit out of somebody who would be bored at work for like a couple of hours.
Right.
And yours is that quintessential concept.
Sure.
I sat here for like 2 or 3 hours last night. I watched all of your videos.
Oh, really?
Fantastic.
Oh, Jesus. Okay. Thanks, man.
Man, I didn't know Ashton Kutcher did some racist.
Oh, man. Dude, it was crazy.
And it's so great that you called him out on it.
Oh, thanks, man. It was crazy. When that Pop Chips campaign went up, someone sent it to me. They had put it up on YouTube, and within like 3 or 4 hours, they had just taken it down. There was just like all this negative backlash of like, what the fuck? Like, why is this dude in brownface?
Who the fuck does he think he is to be doing an Indian accent with brownface?
Brownface, it was crazy. And it was like, it was one of those things where I was like, who, like,
approved it?
Yeah, like, there's so many failures on so many different levels. Like, him to be like, yeah, let's do this. Like, the ad team, like, I've done commercials. There's so many hands in the pot. So that's like,
Jesus. It reminded me of when Ted Danson did the blackface thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, who is this arrogant, rich television actor
to act
like a minority?
But what about the executives being like, yeah, that's fine.
Right, and they'll never ever get
the agents, the managers, the executives, the ad agency that were like, yeah, that's fine. Like, to me, that just, it made a larger statement. And what I kind of said in the video was like, okay, I get the rules now. Basically, Asians and Indians are the clownable minority. You probably still notice it in stand up too. Like, you can always throw an Asian dude under the bus or an Indian
right.
Dude
and it
bus.
it is a really hack joke for like a white guy to sit up there and do that Indian act. I won't even attempt it. I think it's so pathetic.
Right.
But I love that you call him out on it.
Oh yeah, thanks, man. And I didn't know the video really took off, but I just wanted to talk about that. And
well, I know you do a lot of acting and stuff. How much, like, Roberto, our buddy, he's actually of El Salvadorian descent, but he goes in on, it's always the Mexican guy.
Right.
And it's, I know he has frustrations with, it's always the Mexican gangbanger stereotype or the ne'er-do-well. How much of the Indian stereotype do you get in act? Like, you go in for an audition,
right.
Do they want you to do the stereotypical voice?
So this is the way.
Because I know Russell Peters told me that, what was that movie he did? And they were going to fire him.
Oh, really?
Unless he did that voice.
Wait, are you talking about the movie that he did?
That New Year's Eve movie.
Oh, right.
And then at the end, he gets to use his real voice.
Oh, okay.
Like it was just some character he was
playing. Oh, okay. Wow.
But I mean, even Russell gets
that. Yeah. You know, it's crazy. I would say it's like this. Like 50% of kind of what is offered or what is out there for your specific type is as a minority or as just an underrepresented group is just what people immediately think of you as. So I would say that works for like gays, black females, Latinos, Indians, you know, East Asians, all that. That it's what.
So that's got to mean that white people are still writing the scripts.
Yeah.
I mean, don't you think? I thought our society would have evolved to where like there would be enough ethnic mix of people that have gone into these writing jobs.
Totally. I mean, it's starting to change. Like the success of people like Shonda Rhimes with Grey's Anatomy and Scandal and stuff like that. She's a black woman who's like a writer, executive producer. Like that's an amazing, you know, accomplishment. But like, it's still, I mean, just like even with politics, it's still like a top-heavy, WASP-dominated, and male-dominated thing. How many like female directors are there? Very few. Like very few female directors. So like, you know, the Lena Dunhams and all those people, that's very inspiring. It's like, I think that's great. But 50% is just like, it's so like, it's very hackneyed. It's like, it's that. And then the other 50%, which I think is like, it's kind of encouraging, they'll say stuff like open ethnicity. And I actually kind of think that's cool. And a lot of the stuff that I've booked, it was just, the character's name was just like Brian or Seth, open ethnicity. And it was just like the network throwing us a bone so that they wouldn't basically be racist, that we have some sort of diversity there. But I actually think it's great. That's awesome. Like, okay, I can just go in and do what I do, and then may the best man win, whether whatever size, shape, or form he's in. Cool. Like, so about 70% of what I've booked is that, and then like 30% has just been like, okay, you wanted a guy named Bikram, so.
Bikram. I do his yoga. A friend of mine, Raj Sharma.
Raj is great. Yeah,
you know Raj?
Yeah.
He told me last year, he'd been doing some showcases of comedians, and they were only looking for Indians and Asians. And he goes, man, I feel bad for guys like you. Like, white guys don't stand a chance now in this business. So I thought maybe that paradigm was changing for...
Dude, it's like this. Okay. Say Hollywood is like, this is the way I see it. You correct me if I'm wrong. It's like there's this, it's a penthouse suite. It's like a 50-story suite, right? And at the top where like the penthouse is, there's like Brad Pitt, you know, like Leonardo DiCaprio, fucking, you know, like Andrew Garfield who can play Spider-Man. It's just like anything and everything is possible. You can be Captain America. You can be all these things. And if I kill it, if I'm the best dude I can be, I could be the scientist that helps Captain America. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
So it's like, this is the penthouse. This is Hollywood. This is all the opportunity. But we have this great showcase, and it's an ethnic showcase. So you can be the janitor, or you can be the lab assistant, or you can be the resident doctor. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
But like that juicy filet mignon, like...
Leading man.
Leading man, just awesome. So for me, I do agree with you. Like, it's all about perspective. Like, a lot of the people that I talk to are just like, man, it's so unfair. If only I could be just an ethnic minority. I'm like, do you want to be the janitor at the Hollywood penthouse? Like, those are people that are complaining about just getting in the door. But for me, the existence of, like, seeing someone like, you know, a Ryan Reynolds or whatever, seeing those people on billboards is like, and seeing someone who looks like me on billboards is like, oh, it's possible. Just the idea of possibility, it changes a generation and people below you. Like, you're like, oh, that's possible. Like, when I was coming up in San Francisco and seeing, like, Kamau and Moshe and all these guys starting to come up, I thought like, oh, I could maybe do it if I just keep sitting here for the Sunday showcase. So you know what I mean? It's like the idea of possibility.
Well, it seems like a huge well of comedic material for you. Like some of your videos were hilarious. The racist rap battle
with
the guy, and you... Yeah. The black guy insults you and your ethnicity, and then you do it to him and call him that he doesn't have a father, and he gets all upset.
God,
it was hilarious.
Oh yeah, he's just like, oh, fuck your girl, you're Aladdin, blue buildings, like, blah, blah, blah. Like, he's just like railing on me, and everyone's like, I'm part of the sketch group called Goatface, and it's like, we kind of are, there's so many topics that I feel like, for whatever reason, well, a lot of sketch comedy that exists right now can't address that stuff because they just don't have cast members that can. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Like, SNL doesn't have anybody, like, they don't have anybody to kind of address a lot of this type of stuff.
I think if Saturday Night Live got their eyeballs on some of your work, I think you'd be there in a heartbeat. Like, the one about the Indian Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
And you're talking to your parents, and it's hilarious. You go, the evil doctor's destroying the city, and your dad goes, at least he's a doctor.
Oh, man. Dude, yeah, man. It's crazy. Like, I'm doing this new HBO show called Getting On, and it's like, I'm playing a resident doctor on it, and I told my parents, like, that, oh, like, I booked this thing, and they're like, it's so funny. Like, they totally would rather have me be a doctor.
Than a comedian.
Yeah. Dude, this is the thing. I see it, like, just like we were talking about this earlier, when I see all this work, it's so inspiring how you have all this stuff going on. What's next? What's next? What's next? And you can create every day. Whereas with them, I do a project and I explain it to them, and then they're like, "That's great. What do you do? What are you gonna do now?" And they see that as terrifying, and I sometimes see that as terrifying. But I still kind of.
So you do have the stereotypical Indian parents.
Oh, totally.
If you're not a doctor or a lawyer, you're a failure.
They just don't understand though, because like when I try to, dude, I can barely understand Hollywood and all its inner workings. I'm trying to explain first generation people that, like, my father and mother are from this town in India called Aligarh, which is right outside Delhi, who came here. They, like, established somehow within one generation, established, like, jobs, respectable jobs. Like, they've held their jobs for a long period of time. They had a family. Like, for them to kind of be so practical, pragmatic, and, like, lay out a plan and execute that plan to then have a son that's an artist, where there is a plan, but there's really kind of no plan. It's very free-flowing. It's difficult for them to understand because their notion of Hollywood is rooted in their notion of Bollywood. And in Bollywood, there's like maybe 10 stars, and that's it. And everybody in the whole country knows who they are. So for my parents, it's kind of like, well, so if you're not Tom Cruise or Will Smith, then what are you doing?
Well, I got to work to that, Dad. It's a ladder. You don't start out at the top.
Yeah, but they don't. It doesn't even matter. For me, I'm like, I don't even care if the top. To me, like, working is the coolest. I think it's like, it's
right.
Awesome.
There's no heavy lifting, and
yeah, man,
it's great. You're not unloading boxes off a truck. But I think, like, it's amazing, like, what your parents did. I love it when you hear, like, ignorant white people in the South and different parts of the country, and they're like, well, God, look at these people, and I can't get ahead. And was like, your family's been here for, like, 9 generations.
Yeah.
And you still can't get your shit together.
My thing is...
And then you got Indians and Asian people coming here, and, like, boom, one generation, they've already got their... Kids are all educated, and
dude, this is what I feel. I feel like the struggle that African Americans went through really laid the pavement for us to come in and really like succeed very quickly. There isn't all this institutionalized shit that we had to deal with. Do you know what I mean? They had to deal with. We kind of benefited. So there was this group of people that left the Middle East and South Asia during the late 70s and early 80s that were able to come here and just like establish themselves. And I'm super, super grateful for that. But when I go and I do the South, you know, a few years ago I did all these like colleges, and I was doing like all these NACA colleges, and I would also do clubs. And when I would do clubs and like one-nighters, I was like terrified, dude. It was just like...
I was too as a white guy starting out.
I couldn't put my finger on it. Like, is it a threatening thing? Like, is it just like people just don't like things that are different?
But now you've like, you know, you did the immigration and the way it's been in the United States. I mean, I love now when you go like to the South and you'll see like an Indian or Asian person and they got a real Southern accent and they've been there and that's where they're from.
Yeah.
I mean, you think people would have grown up now with different ethnicities,
right,
that they would
but
be used
dude,
to.
But dude, they enter a lot of immigrants. I'll say this as a first generation, I'm a child of first generation, and a lot of people, a lot of my friends and stuff are first generation kids, like Korean American or Filipino American and stuff like that. And dude, all of our stories are similar. Like, dad landed in 81, 82, 83. Like, came here, he worked at a pizza parlor. Came here, worked at, a liquor store. And it's like, you still go to your local liquor store, and I'll still see Mahmoud and Abdul and Aziz and all these people there. And it's like, I immediately look at it, I'm like, I know your story. I know if you have a son, he's probably like me. Like, for you to be threatened by a guy who's literally entering and doing nominal jobs,
right,
if they're able to somehow rise from that, I don't know how you see that as not... How do you not see that as inspiring? Or how do you not just make that be like,
why wouldn't you see these people and go, God, that is the American dream in full effect?
Totally, man.
But there is the surprising levels of ignorance, like the guy that went into that Sikh mosque and shot the people and he thought they were Muslim.
Yeah, he just went into that temple and just like lit these dudes up. Dude, the saddest part was when that happened was like, you know, it really happened in the wake of that Colorado shooting. And like, I remember during the Colorado shooting, okay, so the Colorado shooting happened, and for me, a litmus test of where the pulse of like where we are as a society, I think social media is that, you know, like people are like, these are my thoughts here, if good or bad. I could see people rally behind the Colorado thing. Like, as Americans, we need to stand against, you know, guns. As Americans, we need to like mourn the death of other Americans, all that stuff, which is awesome. It was great. And when those 7 American citizens and the police officer were killed, like, no one really said anything. Like, the only people that posted about it were other South Asians.
Right. People weren't as upset as the Colorado shooting.
Yeah, and I was like, dude, this was like a straight-up hate crime. Like, this, a guy walks into a temple and just lights up people. And like,
well, I love that you said that in the video that you made on your website. Because there's always, when there's terrorist stuff, you know, you always hear Americans say, you know, well, why aren't enough Muslims standing up and saying this is wrong?
Uh-huh.
And speaking out against
it.
And that's so great for you to, you know, call Americans on that. Like, well, yeah, where's the outcry of white Americans going, you know, hey, that's one lunatic.
Totally. Well, I feel like there wasn't just enough, like, Americans should be mourned regardless of their race, ethnicity. People should be mourned, but fine, if we want to be national, you know, have national pride, Americans should be mourned regardless of their race, ethnicity, creed, or class. Straight up. Like, that's just, I think, you know, and a lot of these, dude, like, the Colorado shooting, the Sikh massacre, the Trayvon thing, it's really, like, opened my eyes to, like, classism and racism in America. You know, like, a comic friend of mine in New York caught a lot of flack when he spoke out about the Trayvon thing, where he's like, the Trayvon thing is terrible. You know, how Zimmerman did kill him and stuff like that. But he's like, how many times do people just not care when it's black on black crime?
Right.
You know, and just people don't say anything. And that's just an example of, like...
Right. Well, I'm actually from that area where Trayvon was killed.
Uh-huh.
Sanford is the biggest city in the county of...
Oh, really?
Seminole. I'm from Oviedo.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, there's some old world Civil War racism shit there. But I was living in Europe when that Stand Your Ground law came out. And there were editorials in The Guardian saying that this will make it possible for people to be able to shoot dark-skinned people.
Jesus.
I mean, and that law came out, I don't know, 10 years ago. I mean, and they were predicting it then.
Uh-huh.
It just took this long for it to catch
up. Why do you think, like, places like why Florida such a... Every time an election happens, or any time something like of... kind of like kind of social political change happens, Florida's like a super tumultuous place. Why is that? Like, it hasn't evolved, it hasn't changed. What is it about?
You know what? I think it's evolved so much from when I grew up there, and then when, like, things like this happen, you just realize, well, no, it's fucked up, man. I mean,
it changes dramatically, too, geographically, too. Like,
well, because, like, the Central Florida, where I'm from, was very redneck when I grew up there. But now there's loads of South Americans.
Oh, really?
Loads of Asians and Indian people there.
Uh-huh.
You know, I thought that it had evolved, but there's still pockets of old world Civil War racism and shit.
Right.
And then it complicates the matter that the guy was Hispanic.
Yeah. That was so interesting. Like, the way the media spun that, because it still was minority on minority crime, you know, but they kind of made it like almost like white America against Trayvon, which I thought was interesting. You know what I'm saying? I don't understand, because George Zimmerman is Latino, you know, like, so... But anyways, yeah.
I don't know. You know, like the Colorado shooting, you think, okay, well, we would outlaw semi-automatic weapons or like the large clips.
Right.
But that didn't happen. And then you think the Trayvon murder would, you know, reverse the Stand Your Ground. But it doesn't. I don't know why our country's so hard-headed in these gun laws.
I was in South Africa, right? And I was doing stand-up there in Johannesburg. This is actually, I was talking to a fellow friend of ours, Maria Shahada. She's the one, when I was telling her this story, she was like, you should totally talk to Tom. So I go to South Africa and I'm doing stand-up in Joburg. And before I left, the cover of Time magazine had a thing on South Africa, and there was a gun above the country. So about, you know, how guns are really crazy in South Africa. And when I got to Johannesburg, the first thing that I noticed wasn't the fact that it was, like, dangerous. I thought it'd be seedy and crazy. It was, like, it was great. It was beautiful. Like... it looked a lot like California. Like, when I got on the freeway, I was like, am I leaving LAX? Like, wide roads, billboards, like, clean, manicured, like, it, you know, there was a lot of, like, order, first world type order to it. Whereas, like, sometimes when you go to India, it's a developing country. Have you ever been to India?
No.
Okay, you gotta go. As a world traveler,
It was always my lifelong dream, and my wife is Indian.
Oh, really?
She's from Holland, but my wife is Indian.
Oh, no kidding.
And
what part of India is her family from?
The north, but they were so far removed.
We're northern, too.
Her family migrated to Suriname.
Uh-huh.
After slavery ended, Indians were very cheap labor and dispersed on ships all over the world, especially the Caribbean.
Yeah.
So Suriname is a tiny country at the top of South America.
It's amazing that you know that.
Above Brazil.
A
lot of people
don't. A lot of people don't know
that. It's next to French Guyana and British Guyana, where Jim Jones did the Kool-Aid massacre. Uh-huh. And ultimate historic trivia, the Dutch traded what is now Manhattan to the British for Suriname.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, seriously?
Worst trade ever.
Yeah, it's horrible.
But, I mean, at the time, historically, on the shipping routes, that seemed like a very
important... That's up there with the Louisiana Purchase.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, what are those?
So,
like,
Suriname was a Dutch colony, and her parents immigrated to Holland when she was, like, 1 year old.
Okay.
So, she's Indian, but her family are, like, Caribbean and Dutch.
Yeah, yeah. Have you ever met Jerry Bednob? Because he's from, like, Trinidad, so... he's, like, very far removed. His family's very far removed from, like, India as well. But, Like, he has those right. roots as well.
Oh, but my wife is 100% Indian, but she's so far removed from Indian culture. I mean, her family is Hindu.
Okay.
And her mother became a Christian, but the rest of her family are Hindus. Her father was actually Muslim, but...
Oh, really? No kidding.
So very complicated
ethnic
mix. Now, what are your family? Are they...
My family's Muslim, yeah.
Are they really?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, yeah.
It's such a complicated place.
Indian Muslim, man, dude. They dealt with a lot, man. Because my dad grew up like... You talk about like...
Still, there's constant clashes between the Hindus and Muslims.
Dude,
there.
It's like... Dude. All right, this is an interesting story. So, you know... India and Pakistan Independence Day was literally back to back. It was yesterday and the day before.
I saw you tweeted that. I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, for me, I honestly feel like as an Indian Muslim, and I go back a lot, like I go back to Aligarh, where my family's from, a lot. I feel like partition was stupid. I feel like it's a byproduct of colonialism and the British turning us against each other. East and West Pakistan, East Pakistan being in Bangladesh and the other part being up by where current Pakistan is now. We totally got pimped, and it was totally like them coming in and creating conflict amongst religion, caste, creed, all that stuff. Oh, like they're Sunni, they're Shia, they're Hindu, they're Sikh. How can you let these dirty people be with you? You need to create another country called Pakistan. Bak means clean. And it's just like such bullshit. Like to me, and it creates this like false pride and it's stupid. It was like the dumbest. We're really all the same.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I wanted to ask you about that. I think that 99.9% of the American people have no idea that India and Pakistan were at one time was one country.
Yeah, yeah. Russell has this great joke where he'll like, because he plays an international audience. He saw a brown dude. He goes, "Hey, where's your family from?" Dude's like, "Pakistan," or whatever. He's like very proud about it, and he's like, "Ask your grandfather where he was from." India. That's where, you know what I mean? Like, it was established in, what, like 47 or 46 or something?
So the British divided it after World War II.
It was...
And the British then also, after World War II, with our help, created the State of Israel.
Yeah, I'm...
So, I mean, and as much as people blame America for the world's problems and shit, England fucked everything.
right.
England, England is really to blame.
Right. Dude, I mean, at the end of the day, though, still, like, the people of South Asia ended up making those decisions. But I mean, the whispers of that, of us getting pimped and listening to that. I mean, Gandhi specifically was very anti-partition. He was like, this is the dumbest thing. This is not good. We should not divide India. It's actually us staying together, and having one nation will make us stronger. And he was right, man. And so that's just my whole take on it. Now, my father's from Aligarh, and the way it happened, the people that moved to Pakistan were to migrate to a new country, you had to be very wealthy. You know, India's very big to go from, like, if you're as far as from somewhere as Bangladesh to get to Pakistan is very difficult. My family, my dad, my grandfather was there too poor to move. So they just stayed. And so what's interesting is that the current state of like Muslims specifically in India, it's very poor people that kind of stayed there and have stayed in India. But there's still over 250 million Muslims. There's more Muslims in India than there are in Pakistan.
Wow.
But percentage-wise, obviously Pakistan is a Muslim country, just like Indonesia is like primarily 97 or 98%.
Weren't the Muslims from that Pakistan area, they were supposed to be like the greatest warriors?
They're supposed to be the elite. Like,
and then
the
Sikhs also were supposed to be like phenomenal warriors.
Sikhs specifically, like their religion came from that. Their religion like came from, when the Mughal Empire turned and it kind of became corrupted. They were, those Mughals were killing innocent Hindus, and the Sikhs established... their gurus established a code to be like, we're going to grow our beard and wear turbans to be the public defenders. So they're actually like almost like peaceful warriors. You know what I mean? Where like, it's very interesting. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. Cause yeah. I know when you're a Sikh at a certain age, you get that curvy knife. That's like a real like rite of manhood.
Yeah. 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 Totally.
That's pretty smooth.
Totally.
As a world traveler, I've always wanted to go to India. My wife also. Uh-huh. And then, after we saw Slumdog Millionaire, we're in no hurry.
Hilarious. That's hilarious. Dude, you know
that, like, that put a break on
You know how many Indians in Mumbai, when I went to Mumbai, like, they got mad. They were like, oh, man, like, why don't you show both parts, sides of the story. Because for them, it's like, they're like, on behalf of India's PR team, like, it's more than just, like, slums and gullies and stuff like that.
Right.
It's true. Like, a lot of times, and you probably know this because you've traveled the world, is like, you can't necessarily look at things just through a Western lens. Be like, why aren't there Jamba Juices and air conditioning everywhere? It's like, that's not how the world works. There's some places that have 1.7 billion people, and you have to put that into context. Or there's some places that have, like, centuries and thousands of years of tradition, and you can't just fuck with that in one generation. It's very difficult to do that. That change happens slowly. So, like, they have this booming, growing middle class that is numbers-wise larger than ours, but by Indian standards, it's still small because there's 1.7 billion. But there are still great things that they're doing over there that I think is amazing. Like the stand-up there in South Africa and India specifically, the things they're talking about and the things they're going through. I'm like, dude, I was telling Maria this. I was like, man, it kind of made me want to move there. Specifically to South
Africa. Just to do stand-up.
Just to do stand-up. How did you feel when you moved away from America?
I loved it. I mean, I started doing London a lot. And London, I know the comedy store.
Yeah.
Opened the comedy store in Mumbai.
Yeah.
And then they were bringing in these British acts, and it was too much money.
Uh-huh.
And they realized that there's this wealth of stand-up comedians there.
In India.
So now it's all Indian comedians.
When I was in Delhi, like I saw a poster for like a stand-up comic act. And it was like really, it was really cool. And just going to the shows there, yeah, there's growth to be had, but the stuff that they're talking about, like the way that like
what is it? Very political?
Yeah, very political. Dude, corruption is manageable in India, but it's still bad. I mean, and it's not like it's like in certain countries in the Middle East or in like say Pakistan where it's like very rampant. It's bad. But them calling out government officials, dude, people are like, don't, you could get in trouble. Like, they're literally like that, and that feeling in the air.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, they're changing something. And, I go back and I'm doing stand-up in the States, and I see a lot of comics doing stand-up about stand-up, and I'm like, have we literally run out of material that we have to, like, do jokes about?
Right, and I see a lot of the...
Does that make sense?
100%. A lot of the alternative scene, I think, is just talking about nothing. And inside jokes about show business, where comedy's had a great tradition of, especially in England when it started, of being radical and political, and in the 70s in New York.
Yeah.
And it's almost a shame not to get up there and talk about fluffball shit instead of things that matter.
Sure. And dude, there's these shows that they have pop-up shows where like they'll, because like I said, it's like there's sometimes their material, like there's this very popular podcast that I did in India called All India Buckshot, which is like called All India Like Talking Shit. It got banned because of censorship. The government has heavy censors there. So even though it's a large democracy, in certain ways, it's kind of like China, where it's like, you can't say this about this. You can't put this on television. We have HBO. They don't have stuff like that there. So they had to, like, it got pulled off of iTunes. So they had to take this really popular podcast and find workarounds. They put it up on SoundCloud. They put it up on other things. And so people are like, it's almost like this revolution that's happening, like, underground, like, hey, did you get this thing? Hey, super share it. Oh, they took it down. All right, now we're going to put it up on, you know what I mean, this other server, you know, and people are still in droves coming out to shows. And to me, I'm like, that change and that passion is inspiring. Like, that's really cool to me. Where coming from the States, I don't know. It's there, but it's not there like that at all.
Right.
You know, in Johannesburg, like, apartheid is a very fresh wound. It was lifted in 94. Mandela's about to die. I don't know. Maybe he's already dead. Maybe he's just a hologram, right? I don't know. But the first colored comedian started performing there in 97.
Wow.
So it's like, dude, like the things they're talking about are, they're talking about like race and class and all these things that are affecting their country. And just in real time, that's really cool to me. That speaks to me a lot. And
right.
That just made me go like, shit, man. And I looked at like these guys, like your act is like really great. Like, you talk about really smart shit. I saw this YouTube clip of you in like 95. I was just thinking at the punchline. first of all, the punchline hasn't really changed that much, one. But two, I was like, man, fuck, man. That joke about you, the whale thing and the Rwanda thing and you eating pizza, I'm like, dude, that stuff still holds. You know, that's a great joke, man. It's like, you know, it's like, what, you know, however many years old. But it's like, I was like,
well, and that's what
I was like, that could still work. But it's a great joke.
Well, like I was telling you that, you know, I started in the South and I moved to San Francisco because a higher intelligence of comedy came out of there, I always thought. And so, like, for me, and the punchline is my favorite club in the United States.
It's one of the
best rooms, and because I felt that in San Francisco, you were encouraged to talk about social-minded things and you could talk about world events,
right,
you know?
Right. What I'm trying to say by that is that, like, how many in the United States of America, how many great, I hate using this word, smart, cerebral, great smart comics like that are talking about like stuff on a world or global or even national scale like that are celebrated, truly celebrated, you know, besides your Bill Maher's and your Jon Stewart's, whatever. It's a very small number.
Right.
Do you know, in relation to like fluff comics that are really celebrated.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I think it's
maybe it's somehow subtly repressed
by
the powers that be, the same people that are putting out the scripts of the stereotypical Indian shopkeeper, and you know, maybe you can't rise in American show business if you're talking about socially minded things. I don't know. I mean, you see, and that's what I got to tell you, man. I friggin' fell in love with you last night.
Thanks,
watching
man.
Your clips.
Thanks,
like,
man.
Yeah, this guy is fucking putting his dick out there.
Thank you, man.
You are like that. I thought it was brave and like it's smart talking about shit that matters, like the Jeremy Lin racism
thanks,
it's really good stuff, man.
Thanks, man.
So I have a confession to make. For years, I've been trying to make a comedy travel show.
Okay.
And it's my life as a comedian. And checking out comedy scenes around the world and then highlighting comedians from those places. And I was actually being considered for this Stand Up Planet.
Oh, are you serious?
That you got.
Okay.
And so, and I thought, man, this is my friggin' show.
Uh-huh.
And when I didn't get it, my wife, she was looking it up online, and and she was more pissed than I was.
Really?
She was like, oh, of course, they went with some cute Indian guy. She's like more racist than I was.
That
they, of course, that's what
you know what it was.
The Indian being against an Indian.
You know what it was. The fact that they went to India. This is what it was, dude. The fact that they went to India. I think the reason why is in my act, I slowly started to the past few years, dude. I was repressing like a lot of the stuff that you see online is basically only been the past few years. A lot of the stuff before I was like repressing. I try not to talk about my family and where they came from, and I didn't talk about how often I go back and how a lot of my cousins are still there. They had actually seen that, and they were like, we need someone who can maybe kind of be a liaison to help us go into India. And South Africa has such a big, also Indian population that we were brought over, you know, by the Dutch and stuff like that, and the Afrikaners and stuff as labor. So that, I think, helped more than, because, dude, I've heard a lot about how you are, like, the world traveler guy.
Right, but I'll be honest with you, man. I'm watching your clips last night, and I thought, I would have chosen this guy also.
Really?
And
really?
I mean, I don't have any big hang-up about it.
Uh-huh.
I mean, at first, my emotions were bruised. But then, like, watching you last night, I'm like, oh, my God, the choice was perfectly clear. But here's the thing that irked me.
Uh-huh.
At first, because like the money that funded it was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was told that this was going to be a PBS project.
Uh huh.
So when I didn't get it, and I heard that a younger guy got it, I thought, well, fuck. If I'm too old for the old people intellectual channel,
no.
I'll never be on television. So,
dude.
So it's going to be on Comedy Central now.
We don't know.
Okay.
It still doesn't have.
But it made me feel a lot better that at least it's not on PBS.
Oh, dude.
But I want to hear all about the experience and like going to. You had been to India before.
I had been to India before.
But did you ever check out the comedy scene?
I had never checked out the comedy scene. When I go back to India, I go straight to where my family is.
Right.
That's it. It's just about that. And I have a joke about this. Like, dude, I love that. By the way, side note, I love that page that you have on your website called Happiness. Dude, like, when I go back, whenever I travel and step out of my little bubble, you know, I realize that, like, I can just add to that list. dude, when I go visit my cousins in Oligarh, I feel like the rapper that made it. It's like the same house that my dad kind of basically grew up in. You know, it's like the same cots that he slept on or whatever. And I'm just like, Jesus, I'm lucky. Like, I'm so lucky. He has like six brothers. They all look relatively similar. Why did Najmi, how did he get out? Like, what if it was Rashid, the other brother? It's like, I lucked out. That's straight up it. That's all it is. And so, like, it just makes me realize, like, dude, I'm lucky. I can't take any of this stuff for granted. Because it could have easily been the other way around.
Right.
Easily. Or none. I took my sister's...
What do your relatives in India think about you being a comedian?
Like, they just don't...
Like, what the concept is.
Stand-up comedy isn't an institutionalized thing the way it is kind of sewn into Americana here. Over there, their live performers go back to a different type of tradition. It's physical comedy. It's very much like, so a man walks into a room, blah, 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 and then he says, that's what my wife does. It's like that. It's very like
right. Now, a lot of
street jokes.
A lot of poor countries around street the world, jokes. Their comedy on television revolves around a gay guy stepping on a rake and getting hit in the balls.
Right.
That is comedy gold on television.
Right. But there's these young generation of kids. So I went to Mumbai, and Mumbai is very far removed. Mumbai is their Hollywood. It's where Bollywood is. It's where their stars are. It's where like their models go. It's like beautiful women everywhere. It's like, it's not as working class as say Delhi.
Right.
You gotta
go.
Okay. So it's not as working class as Delhi. So when I went to Mumbai, that's where they said, this is where the scene is happening. And that's where I saw all these young kids who are familiar with you guys, man. You,
YouTube.
Arj, Mark Maron, Margaret. They know about, you know, that era of you in the 90s. They know all this stuff. They're reading up about you guys.
They're students like it's of stand-up comedy.
This
right.
girl I met there, Aditi Mittal, she goes, can you introduce me to Elaine Boozler? I read about her in this book.
Wow.
In this book, I'm Dying Up Here, about the Comedy Store. And so she's just like, you know, she found her on Twitter, and she's like, I love her tweets, and... So what you guys did and are doing and what we are all doing is sent this ripple across the world. They're seeing it, observing it, and then they're putting their own spin on it. But the same way like a lot of comedians like during previous eras would like kind of talk about the government or, you know, break shit down and be like, hey, this is fucked up, this is wrong. They're doing that. But right now there's a lot of tension with it. But I think that's great. It's great for their comedy.
It's awesome. I made a little pilot on Malaysia a couple years ago. They got a great comedy scene there. You got Malay Muslims, Indian Hindus, and Chinese Christian or Buddhist. That's cool. Their ethnic populace, and that's their comedy scene.
Uh-huh.
And so Russell Peters introduced...
Did you and Gina do shows in like Jakarta?
Yeah, we did.
And stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then I was back not long ago with Paul Ogata, and I just did it a few months ago. It's a phenomenal tour. You'd love it.
So
you do Singapore, Kuala Lumpur, and then Jakarta.
Oh, really?
It's fantastic.
Uh-huh.
But Russell Peters introduced a lot of people to stand-up comedy, but they all attribute YouTube. And so, like, they are studying the masters on YouTube. You know, they're just hungry for knowledge of stand-up comedy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that sounds like what you're describing with Indian comedians.
Yeah. And they're super smart. They're super... And so what's happening is just... There's this dearth of information. They're absorbing it. And then they're applying it. They're like, okay, we have to get up every night. We got to create venues to get up every night. So they're like... They see this beautiful, like, palace of stand-up comedy that we've created in the States, and they're just like drilling away, like, all right, we need a club, okay, like, okay, Mumbai Comedy Store, okay, we need a tour, all right. So now they've created tours, and they're just creating all this stuff. They had their first comic pop from stand-up into film, and I'm like, oh, you mean like Eddie
Who's
Murphy?
That?
I mean, his name is Veer Das, and he's now in like major Bollywood movies.
I did this thing in Amsterdam, and they had comedians from all over the world, and Papa CJ was on it, and he, I heard, is very smart. He started to produce his own shows.
Yeah.
And I guess he has a management company or something.
Where, yeah.
Where you're talking about, I mean, the guy, his vision was bigger than just being a stand-up comedian.
Uh-huh.
This whole opportunity isn't just about telling jokes in a club. It could be bigger.
So South Africa, have you gotten Trevor Noah on this podcast?
I would love to. I worked with Trevor a couple years ago, and he was emceeing at the Improv, and I loved him.
At the Improv here in the States?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I had no idea that he was like a superstar. This was before he, in the last 2 years, he's really blown up.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to have him on, and then he had left Los Angeles by the time I came back.
Yeah.
Trevor is, oh my God, a brilliant performer.
Yeah.
And I love, you know, he talks about, you know, the reality of his white father and a, you know, black mother, and it was illegal for them to be together in South Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, that, you can't fake the funk.
Right.
That's,
yeah, man.
Such a unique story.
Yeah.
And he's such a good looking, smart, funny guy.
When you go to South Africa, you see billboards of like, the way they celebrate stand-ups in South Africa, these guys will have billboards about their one-man shows. They call their specials one-man shows. And what's so great is that there's not this pressure to be like, I just need to create 60 minutes of content or 60 minutes of funny. It's like, I'm going to dissect this one story. And Comedy Central Africa is so hungry for content that they will shoot your specials. And that's why I wanted to ask you, when you were first working with Comedy Central America, like, was it like that, where they're just like, hey, we need content, like, we need to shoot specials, we need to whatever. But what's great over there is that comedians are celebrated, people come out to see you in droves, there's an audience for you, and people are talking about smart shit that to me matters, that's kind of changing the face of the way we live our lives. They're part of something, a cause.
For me, that was what stand-up comedy meant, was to talk about... I mean, I had an epiphany as a young comedian a few years in that, you know, oh my God, you don't... It doesn't have to be hacky bullshit. You can talk about important things if you can make it funny. And that's
exactly,
that's the challenge.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because if it's not funny, then you're just some asshole blathering on about...
So my question was this, man. I know this has been a huge build-up to this question. I'm in there in South Africa, and I see, we're driving to the gig. I see the billboards. We go to this little black box theater. Oh, we go to this little black box theater where I'm a guest. That I'm just the guest performer that night. This is for the show. They're just like, you're just one of the guest performers. A couple of the comics, they tweet that, hey, come to the show. You know, we have a special guest who's going to be coming and performing with us too. Whole place is sold out just off of a few of their tweets. And the crowd was great. They were so welcoming. You could just, you know, those moments when you look out and they're just like this. They're leaning in and
hanging
like,
on everywhere.
On listening. Just, okay, so this is your first time here. Okay, so that's where you're from. Like, I was like, oh man, I'm not fighting anything. No check drop, no clanking, no chicken fingers. Just people are here to listen. Let's talk about Mandela. Let's talk about apartheid. Let's talk about Oligarch. I want to listen to it all. I'm like, what? Why am I in the States?
It sounds like something...
Dude!
You make it sound like something more exciting is happening over there.
Yes. You left the States for a while. Did you find... What I'm trying to ask is, did you find more happiness elsewhere? Did you find more purpose elsewhere? Because it made me reckon.
Yes.
It made me reckon with what I'm like, am I living in LA? What am I living in LA for? When I started comedy, it was like, I want to be able to do comedy when I want, where I want. I want to do it in front of an audience. You know, like... Dude, I don't know if you ever did the Brainwash Cafe in San Francisco, but it was hard. You know, that laundromat.
The laundromat, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, I need to get out of the laundromat. I remember, I was like, I would love to just do it in front of people that want to be there. So do comedy when I want, where I want, in front of an audience, and be compensated, hopefully well, for it, so I can have, maybe get married and maybe have a kid or something someday where I can, you know, live a comfortable life. And there, clearly, stand-up comics live that life. It's not just like, you have to be comedian, actor, host. It's like, no, I'm just a stand-up comedian, and I lived that.
That's all I ever wanted to do, was be a comedian. And then I got really popular on Comedy Central, and then I ended up having a sitcom on NBC, which I had no control over. I had long hair. It was all these hair jokes thrown at me, and it was this really frustrating thing that I was given a bunch of money for. But really, kind of, I was pissed off at humanity and especially show business afterwards. And then, if you set your clock by Hollywood, your feelings are always going to be hurt. If you let Hollywood dictate how you feel about yourself as a person and a performer, you're always going to be feeling like a failure.
Uh-huh.
So I moved to New York for a couple of years, and then just to focus on stand-up. And then I started branching out to Europe, specifically London, because I just wanted to be a comedian and be happy.
Yeah.
And so I was quite happy to wash my hands of the States for a while. I mean,
yeah.
I still kept coming back and doing, you know, 50% of the year doing gigs here. But I really enjoyed living in another country.
That's great.
Around other cultures. And especially Amsterdam is like a tiny village version of New York City, where you have every ethnicity and nationality from the planet living there. And so you're exposed to people from Israel and India and everywhere you could imagine.
Yeah.
And you know, that I think is it was important to me in my human development.
Right.
And
no doubt. We've never met, so I've read about your story, and I was like, there's part of me, like when Rob was like, come do his podcast, there's part of me that I was like, why did Tom ever come back?
A lot of people ask me that. Why did you leave Amsterdam? I mean,
was life good there?
Well, I was on television.
It
was
fantastic. Totally. But like, do you have a house?
I had an apartment.
Yeah, like
I lived in a building that was older than the United States. It had been built before Columbus discovered.
Are you serious?
The United States. Yeah. Uh-huh. And you know, it's interesting. Like the people there, like I was obsessed with Hindu for a very long time.
Uh-huh.
And
Hinduism.
Yeah, my wife, it blows her away that she's from a Hindu family, and I know more of specific gods and things about than Hindu than she does. So it's so many different flavors of humanity over there. And London, I think, is one of my favorite places to perform. Their comedy scene is kind of shriveled a little bit. It's not as much work as it used to be, but again, you're standing in front of the world when you're on stage in London. I was really interested in hearing about your India and South Africa experience. And so from what I understood the concept, did they take like so you go to Mumbai and then you go to Johannesburg.
Yes.
And was it kind of like a contest where they took
and
then they got to come to the United States?
I told them, I was like, look, I'm too, I'm not a little kid, but I'm by no means am I a veteran. I'm 27, so I'm like, I am still learning so much about stand up. I'm by no means like, do I know everything there is to be known about? I'm learning, so I'm like, there's no way I'm going to judge anybody. If this is a contest, I do not want to be a part of it, because the last thing I want to do is judge one of my fellow dude. I feel like we're like brothers, man. Comics, like in this like.
Right, and that's why I would never do Last Comic Standing, because I would be like, somebody passed judgment on me, and I'd go, weren't you my feature act in St. Louis?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I do. For comedians passing judgment on comedians publicly.
Publicly, yeah. I know we do
because
we all
we're all petty little bastards and talk shit about each other behind each other's back.
Privately, but yeah, man, I was like, no, we can't do that. So they were just like, look, they're like, look, there are people that we've pre-interviewed. You get to know them. Like, I guarantee you, like, this is the person that we think, just on their story alone and what they're doing, a combination of their story plus talent, we're going to bring this person back.
So a few performers did get to come to the United States.
They got so...
Because I thought that was a pretty exciting element to it. Like, wow, you talk about a dream... movie script for some of these people probably coming from very poor circumstances and then they're filming for a television show in the United States.
So the girl that got to come from India, was her name was Aditi Mittal, and she is the only female performer in Mumbai. The only. Talk about stand-up already being a boys club. Dude, she's like, she goes through a lot. So, and her story is great. Like, she lives with her mom. Her mom is one of the very few female television executives in India. She works on a 1-hour drama show. So it's just like a very inspiring story. Like, and what I think that she has brought back to India is, like I said, like that hope to be like, yeah, I'm going to stick with this. Cause there's a lot of pressure for her to not do it. Cultural and industry pressure to not. Then this guy named Umpo Pops out of South Africa, Johannesburg. We got him specifically because like His story's really great. Like, one of the big things that the Gates Foundation was working on is HIV and AIDS awareness. He lost one of his uncles to HIV and AIDS. Mm. And, like, a big thing there is there's this big stigma there. People don't talk about it. Like, in America and other places around the world, they champion you if you have cancer. Like, we're going to fight for you. We're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, kick cancer's ass. But if you have HIV or AIDS, it's like, what'd you do? You fucked up. You know what I mean? You're shamed, so you don't talk about it.
Right, or punishment from God or something
sure.
like that.
And one of the things that he's trying to do is, like, dude, don't lie. Like, just don't lie about it. Like, one thing that he said killed his uncle was not only HIV and getting medication late, but was the stress of, like, hiding it all the time. Mm. So he was losing all this weight, and people were like, what's wrong with you? And he's like, I'm sick, I'm not feeling well, I'm on a diet. Like, he's like, we need to change the culture and be like, I have this, okay? And, like, don't shame me. Let's, like, embrace me, you know? And so, like...
So did this guy talk about that stuff on stage?
Yeah, and he did it in a really funny way.
Wow.
Yeah, he did it, like, in a really funny way. He told this great story about, like, his uncle who has, like, AIDS. Like, how do you take a girl on a date when you're, like, coughing and, like, all this. Like, yeah, he did it in a really, like, funny way. Like, it was really great. It was awesome. So, yeah.
I saw this other thing that you did, this dating thing on MTV.
Oh, Jesus, man.
Oh, my God. That's like, what? It's like the worst date ever? And you're like, Tony?
Disaster date?
You're just this arrogant prick named Tony?
Oh, yeah. When I... When
God,
I
God rested on the seventh day because he spent the first six days creating Tony?
Yeah. Oh, dude. It was like, I did this, I did this when I first moved to LA, like, I auditioned, like, you know, like, in the wake of, like, Punk'd and all that stuff. They had this prank show called Disaster Date. So, like, they had comedians come in and, like, be, like, characters and, like...
That was perfectly executed. I mean, like...
Oh, thanks, man.
You seem like such a nice guy in real life, but...
Dude!
What a cock!
Dude, the first few dates that they sent me on, they were like, Hassan, you're not mean enough. And I'm like... They're like, Hassan, you gotta be mean to these people. And I'm like, dude, I cannot do this. There's, like, a... I'm going... They would set you up on dates with, like, a 19 or 20 year old girl, and her friend would be feeding you lines. Oh, talk about her hair, she hates her hair. Like, Jesus. Like, oh, ask her about her dad, her dad's not in her life anymore. I'm like, I can't do this. So what I tried to do is just make it really absurd, make me be the weirdo, not like them, the weirdo, as much. And anyways, I did it for a season, and then after that I was like, I don't know if I have it in me to, like, still be really mean, like, you know, even though at the end of 60 minutes, when you tell them they're on television, they'd be okay with it. But during those, like, during that hour when I'm on the date with them, I'm like, I'm fucked up. I'm a bad person. This is wrong. Like, what am I doing?
Have you had a lot of acting training?
You know, I just studied theater in college. That's it. You know, I just took acting class. But really, stand-up was the main thing. That's it.
It was great. And so, and you're hosting the show Failosophy?
Failosophy on MTV.
Is that still on?
No, we got,
oh, that's a pity. I thought that was a really, really clever show.
We were only on for one season. Yeah. We finished season one, but the numbers were great and the feedback was really great. It's just, you know, one of those things, like, you know, the business.
And the internet, taking premises and ideas from the internet and addressing them.
Can I ask you a question? What was it like when you like had your show, Mr. Rhodes, like, for the first, did you feel like the weight, there was a lot of responsibility on your shoulders? Did you feel...
When it started, I was really excited, you know, and I had always been very critical of sitcom television, and I thought, well, fuck, how many people, you can complain about shit all day long, how many people actually have a chance to, you know, do something about it?
Yeah.
And then once I got in there, I was in quicksand, and...
What do you mean? Like, just like...
You know, the pilot, they used a few of my jokes, and then after that, they actually got, they got rid of the kids were supposed to be a background thing, and then they got new kids, older kids who were, late teenagers, early 20 people. Uh-huh. The focus became about them. Uh-huh. I became the nice advice guy.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't even get any jokes. And then, people would insult me. In my looks, and the script would say, Tom reacts. Uh-huh. How many times can you fucking shrug and make a face?
Uh-huh.
And I would say, look, anybody I ever considered a hero was witty and didn't take shit from people and would, you know, kung fu counter-react the move and slam them. But
Were there so many people involved that's like you can't fight back? Is that it?
Yeah, and then it was like I kept living on the promise of the script would be better next week. And then, oh my God, we did so many holiday shows. We did a Valentine's show, a Thanksgiving show, a Halloween show, a Christmas. Uh-huh. And then it was like, man, if the premises are that weak on the first season, it's never gonna. Right. And I was kind of relieved when it finished. And it was incredible pressure because imagine a publication you have loved your whole life.
Right.
Saying that you suck. I loved Entertainment Weekly from its inception.
Wow.
And I had a subscription. Uh-huh. It came to my door.
Uh-huh.
And they just, oh my God, they did not only ripped it, Ken Tucker and Matt Bianco
uh-huh.
from USA Today, uh-huh. if I'm ever in a restaurant and overhear that they're at the next table, I'm diving across the table with a shrimp fork.
I love that.
And
give them a piece of your mind.
And then Entertainment Weekly did this hair chart. 1 through 5, best hair on television, David Duchovny, a little cut out of his head. And then
uh-huh.
5, worst hair on television, Tom Rhodes, and a little cut out of my head. And it uh-huh. was like, are you fucking kidding me?
Uh-huh.
I'm in the situation, I have no control over it.
Yeah.
I have a show dumped on top of me, and then on top of that, I get bludgeoned by some of these publications.
Man.
So it was fucking hard. And I was a little pissed off when it finished.
What? You know,
so I think when you get to that level, and especially a guy like you,
what advice
who's good looking and you're skyrocketing,
uh-huh.
you need to follow the Seinfeld paradigm and hold out as long as you can.
Uh-huh.
Just keep, don't go for the first thing. I thought I was holding out somewhat, but just be a prick, say no,
uh-huh.
and just you wait until it is like Louis C.K. did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You wait until take less money,
right.
so you can have more control.
Uh-huh.
That's what Louis did.
Uh-huh.
Go with a cable channel instead of a network.
Right.
So you're going to have more control. I mean, you have to be really smart when you are skyrocketing.
Did it, for you, was it like, I mean, dude, like just with Philosophy, it was one of those shows that I auditioned for and you get it. And how did you deal with like negative criticism? Were you just like, am I not funny? Am I like...
No, I didn't see that. I thought, why can't these people see that I have no control over this show?
Right, right.
I didn't... Okay, you are a television critic,
uh-huh.
and you're going to think that I created a show
uh-huh.
where I never say anything funny,
right,
and it's
right.
constant...
Right. And I'm a stand-up comedian.
Hair jokes thrown at me?
Right, right.
Yeah, I don't know. I was pissed that they... didn't defend me, I guess, and say,
right.
is this the best you can write for this stand-up comedian?
Yeah.
But that's not the way it worked.
Do you feel like you're like, man, like maybe I should have been one of the head writers, or maybe I should have spent time in the writer's room?
I should have. Well, no, I would walk in the writer room, and they would act like I was the enemy. They would be completely quiet until I left. And
wow.
I would go talk to the executive producer and say, look, dude, you're killing me.
Uh-huh.
You got to give me some jokes. I photocopied all these like things from my notebooks, and I'd bring them in, and then I'd bring in jokes that I wrote that I thought would fit in the script,
yeah.
and he would push it away and go, "We've got that taken care of."
Wow!
So I mean, I was just a pawn in a game I had no control over.
No kidding.
So if you are rising quickly
uh-huh.
as a stand-up comedian in television, you know you really need to protect that. And I thought I did, but it spun out of control.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wonder is, like, with the international comedy scene booming and stuff like that, I saw in South Africa, one of the comics that we met there, what was so cool is, like, comics, they were self-producing their own movies that they would distribute in movie theaters.
Wow.
So one of the comedians that we interviewed, Kagiso, he shifted from doing stand-up, and now he's more of like a director, like kind of like a Louis or Woody Allen type, where he's like, I direct it and I write it. But I went to his movie premiere, and it was think of like an AMC theater where you're just like Superman, this movie, big box office, and then his movie was called Blitz Petroli, and I'm like, it was there in the theaters with all the other movies. It was a South African made produced movie. And it was all starring, like, comedians. That was amazing to me. And I was like, man, like that stuff like that makes that level of control that they have in manifesting their destiny. That to me is a little bit more exciting than what happens in the States. The only place where I truly feel I have complete control is the YouTube stuff that I make, which I'm glad, right. Which I'm glad that's what you got to see.
Yeah, and I'm obsessed with that myself. I think I've said it many times. There's never been a better time to be a comedian with all this technological.
Yeah,
I've got my podcast. I'm obsessed with making videos.
Yeah,
and you don't need any suit in Los Angeles to tell you, hey, you're the right guy for this.
No, right.
Fuck that. I'm
right.
Write and create your own stuff.
Right.
And that's how you have ultimate control.
That's cool, man. So, what I was like, the thing that I. What made you go, I'm not, why live somewhere? Why live in one place?
Because there's not enough weeks in the year for all these gigs. And especially, I got into this worldwide circuit. So I do half the year playing outside of the country. Like May, I spent in New Zealand doing the comedy festival. And then 2 months ago, I did that Asia tour. I'm leaving for Rome on Sunday for a couple weeks. My wife is meeting me there.
That's amazing.
November, I'm doing Hong Kong, Beijing, Shanghai.
Okay.
And then the other 6 months of the year, I do all my favorite clubs in the United States.
Yeah.
Punchline San Francisco, Punchline Atlanta, Zany Chicago, Seattle. There's so much work. Why live somewhere? And I was paying rent on a place I was never at.
Yeah.
I would like to have a baby with my wife, so that makes me, I want to try to find a place maybe next year. And I actually would like to move back to the Bay Area. Because San Francisco, you know, I didn't care about being on television. That's why I moved to San Francisco in the first place. I just wanted to focus on, and you know, it's so great also as a comedian now, what has never been before. You know, your comedy recordings are played on Sirius XM radio.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you Sound Exchange, you get these surprise checks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, like, just creating comedy recordings can generate income.
Yeah.
And I'm in love with that concept.
Yeah.
And so I want to make more live recordings. And I want to, I did a new special last year, so I want to work on that next hour. And
Can I watch the old special somewhere?
It's on Netflix. Yeah.
Really?
It's called Light Sweet Crude.
How's it?
Yeah. Then you can buy it off of chill.com if you don't.
How's
have Netflix.
What do you think of the Netflix response?
They're the new HBO. They're great.
That's
and then
awesome.
The other great thing about
so do a bunch of people will go, dude, I saw your thing on Netflix.
Yeah.
That's
well, and
cool.
The other great thing about Netflix, like if you do a special for Showtime, or Comedy Central or something, they'll only show it a handful of times. Maybe not. Comedy Central's worldwide. So you're probably, because I know my older half-hour specials are still played on Comedy Central worldwide because I'll get messages from people. But with Netflix, I made a three-year deal, and it's on in Australia, New Zealand, U.S., Canada, England, and Ireland, and then also in Scandinavia.
Wow.
So you're reaching millions instead of, a few hundred thousand.
So
I think Netflix is fantastic for comedy.
You travel the world. You see, this is like it widens your scope of just like what the human experience can be. Going to Rome, going to Beijing, going to whatever, seeing how people live around the world. You living that way, versus like, do you ever think like, had I decided to just stay in LA and maybe staff write on a show or keep doing like
not the person I am. There was some older comedian, I won't mention his name, who saw me and he didn't know who I was a few weeks ago, and he said, I don't think you should talk about traveling internationally because I think it alienates the audience. And
wow.
I told him, you don't know who I am because that's a big part of my identity.
Yeah.
And traveling is what makes me me.
Yeah.
And you know, my mother is, she was an immigrant from Argentina. So I understand the whole like immigration thing you're talking about. I've got cousins in Argentina. I've seen the way they live, you know, and you know, even among American stand-up comedians, I'm lucky. I'm even beyond luckier than the luckiest comedian because I'm not limited to only playing in the States. I think And I think you could easily do that. I mean, you're already performing and filming stuff in different countries. It's exciting to go to a different country, and then you've got to adjust.
Yeah.
Some material's not going to work. And then, boom, you got to, you know, be very observant.
Dude, you
got to think about
so quick on your feet.
You got to be quick on your feet. It's even more challenging than playing in different parts of the United States.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the exciting thing about being a comedian, is being able... And I figured it out when I lived in San Francisco, because I used to go over to Oakland and do this little black club, Clem Daniels End Zone. And then I did shows, functions for like all gay audiences. And just to be able to go in front of any type of audience and make them laugh, you are a bad motherfucker if you can do that.
Yeah, yeah, totally. How do you... So you develop that past hour, but how do you develop the new hour when you're traveling to all these different places? Because you got that Beijing 30, and then you combine it with that other 30, and then is that the hour you do in Beijing versus the hour you're about to do at Flappers this weekend? How do you get? Do you know what I mean? That's the one thing that there's this 30-minute set that I did in Joburg about shit in South Africa and Mandela and all this stuff, and it did great, but I'm like, what am I gonna? I can't do it here. It's very hard. I've been trying to work it into my act here, but a lot of people don't know who Nelson Mandela is.
Wow. Yeah. Well, there are things that will kill in certain countries that won't work in other countries.
Yeah.
And then you got a bit that's destroying in Australia, and you come back to the States and it falls flat.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like a race car engine. You're just constantly working on it.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But for me, I'm because I did the new special, and I'm trying to work as much new stuff in as possible. But that's why I want to move back to San Francisco.
Yeah.
But then also I'll do a lot of 1 hour shows where it's just me around the world. And it's an hour's a lot of time to work on stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy, man. That's awesome.
So tell me about growing up in Davis, California. One of the most adorable places in the world,
dude.
Does Murder Burger still?
Murder Burger still there?
Do they still sell the pumpkin milkshakes?
Pumpkin milkshakes. And
I would get off the highway to go get a fucking pumpkin milkshake.
Pumpkin milkshake.
Whenever I'm driving by Davis.
Ostrich Burger. They still got it.
Do they have an Ostrich Burger?
They got an Ostrich Burger. Yeah. Murder Burger was the name for a very long time, and then about 7 or 8 years ago, actually a little bit longer, about 10 years ago, they were like, it's too bloody, it's too gory. We need someone to change. We're having a contest. Give us a new name for our restaurant. Whoever wins this contest gets free Murder Burger for life. So me and all my friends, we are racking our brains. We are racking our brains. Ostrich Burger, home of the, you know, we were just thinking of all these names. And what ended up winning was Red Rum Burger. That was the guy, some guy was just like, yeah, Murder Burger, just do it backwards, Red Rum Burger.
Wow.
And I'm like, how is that not?
Because
not
they're like so dark? Politically sensitive.
Yeah.
That they,
you know, come on, man. Davis, we have a frog tunnel over that overpass. There's a frog tunnel? Yeah, so the frogs cannot get killed over that overpass. Dude, it was cool. It was great. You know, my dad works in agriculture. He works for the Cal EPA, Environmental Protection Agency. So it's like, I grew up in its fields everywhere. I grew up, you know, looking at like the little bugs and the little pesticides that he would test and all that stuff. It's cool. It was a small town vibe, but also it was interesting how it was a college atmosphere, so people were very intelligent. But then Davis is weird. It's very much kind of like the Midwest of California a little bit, where people are. It's a little conservative too, so I not a ton of diversity. I was the only one of maybe two or three other South Asian kids. Whereas,
like, really, because up at the university, I would think there'd be loads of.
You would have thought, but I kind of now there are more. But I felt so jealous and envious of my friends, of my Indian friends that grew up in Sunnyvale and Fremont and that area, because there's this huge South Asian, Middle Eastern population in the Bay Area. I mean, if you go to Fremont, there's a huge Afghan population. There's a huge, like, Iranian population. There's just a huge South Asian population. And that all came from the tech boom. And then also those guys established restaurants, which were, like, really great. So envious of how good the food is in San Francisco.
Yeah. And so is that where you gelled as a comedian in San Francisco?
Yeah. So I started doing stand-up my freshman
year. But you moved there from Davis. I moved there from Orlando.
Yeah, man.
You had a shorter drive.
Yeah, man. So, dude. Yeah, man. I would go. I would open for people. Did you ever play Laughs Unlimited in Sacramento?
Never. No, I always did the punchline.
You always did the punchline. So I started off, we would go to Old Sacramento to hang out, you know, as kids and stuff. So I started out, and I went to, they had a little room at Bistro 33 in Davis, which was like a little restaurant, and they had Laughs Unlimited and the punchline, and I was just hanging out. I just first started just paying and going to shows there. I would just watch other comedians and pay and sit in the back. And then one time I sat in the front and they started making fun of me. And I'm like, man, I can't sit in the front. They're going to just make fun of me. I'm by myself. I was also dumb enough to sit by myself and eat. I would eat. I was hungry, man. I was like, it's like 18, you know. I was a hungry kid. I was like eating nachos at the Sacramento Punchline. And comics that I know that I'm friends with now. Like, I'm like, I go up to Mikey Winfield. I'm like, Mike, why'd you rip on me, man? I was just like a little kid. And he's just like, I don't know, man. You're just sitting alone by yourself, man. So I did that. And then the comics, older comics, were nice enough to tell me. They're like, dude, you got to start driving to San Francisco. Like, go drive. So I would tell my parents I'm going to Sacramento Punchline. And I would just drive to San Francisco in my car. And they didn't know.
Go check out shows.
Yeah, I would just check out shows. And that's when I got to see. I think I saw you there once too, man. And I got to see you there. I got to see Arch Barker there. I got to see so many, like, I got to see Proops there. And then that's when they told me about the Sunday Showcase, hang on the back. And I just, that's where I started. And so I was like, I'm going to finish my degree at Davis, and then I'm going to move to San Francisco.
That Sunday Showcase at the Punchline, I mean, that was my university. And moving to San Francisco was my stand-up comedy university.
Yeah.
So that's so great that was just down the street for you to check it out and learn from.
Yeah. I was really envious of you guys, man, that there were these iconic eras. What did that feel like?
It was great. I mean, there were so many great comedians around then.
Did you not realize you were part of something? I wonder, like, sometimes I wonder, do the people, like,
that No, are... I was just happy living there, and these were just all my friends. It was like, that. I'm sure the era of people you came up with.
Sure, maybe it's, you can never see it when you're in the eye of the storm, so to speak.
Right, I mean, now you look back on it and like, wow, Jesus, all those, great, you know, 90% of those people went on to comedy greatness.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
There wasn't that much fat. There was, you know, a couple of bullshit people, but they didn't survive.
Yeah, totally.
What is the greatest comedy advice you've ever been given?
Oh, man. Oh, shit. Okay, I'll say this. Okay, this was the cool... This was... I'm still trying to reckon with it. So Stand Up Planet, right? We bring these guys over. So Bill Cosby's an advisor on the project.
Wow.
We got to interview Bill Cosby. So for me, that... I was filming another project. I didn't know if I was going to be able to do the Stand Up Planet project just because of scheduling. But that to me was, I was like, I have to do that. Because I'll be honest, I don't know if I would ever achieve a level where he'd ever care about my existence. That was truly one of my deepest insecurities. I'm like... He very, very well may die, and I very well may never get an opportunity for me to be even remotely relevant enough for him to talk to me. It was a very select handful of people. So we go to his house, his actual house, his house. Photos of Enos are on the wall, like, it's his house. It goes on the wall. Long story short, he sits us down in his front yard, and it felt like Grandpa Cosby telling us about, you know, comedy. But one of the things that he kept reprimanding me, like, he asked me, I tried to interview him. He ended up interviewing us. So he's like, why do you do comedy? And I was like, man, I feel like it was a great platform. He's like, stop. I'm like, oh, shit. You know, and he's just like, why do you do comedy? And I'm just like, I feel like it lets me express myself. He's like, stop. And like, now he's getting closer and closer to my face. And then Umpo, the kid from South Africa, was just like, growing up, people said I was funny. And he's like, that's it. That's it. And I'm like, oh, fuck, why did I say that? Why did I say that? And dude, I'm sweating. Dude, I am sweating.
You want to say the right thing.
Yeah, because I'm like, look, man. And so he's just like, you look nervous. Are you nervous? I'm like, yeah, I'm nervous.
We're talking to Bill Cosby.
Yeah, and I'm like, I'm the American comic. I'm supposed to tell these guys, hey, we're going to go meet Cosby. And he's like, it's Mr. Cosby. What's wrong with you? And I'm like, oh, fuck, man. Like, I can't do anything right. literally, I felt like one of those kids on Kids Say the Darnest Things. Like, there would always be the kids that, like, got it, and then there'd be the one kid, he's just like, you're clearly the slow, you're clearly the slow one. And Cosby, just, like, timing, he would just, like, whip it and then rip me. But it was obviously loving and stuff like that. But one of the best things that he said was, like, was this. Was that I told him that sometimes the things that I talk about, there are not, just people don't want to hear it. People, there are barriers. I would want, like, I have that web series, The Truth with Hasan Minhaj. My dream is maybe one day that could be a show where I could take things that happen in politics.
Those clips culture. Are where I fell in love with you.
Yeah.
The truth.
I would love to do that, you know, but sometimes I've tried to do those segments at shows. People, comedy club audience doesn't want to hear it sometimes.
Right.
And I feel like, I sometimes feel trapped. I feel like, where do I go with this?
Sometimes people don't want to be reminded how scummy the human race is.
Sure. But like the Jeremy Lin video was a thing about how cool this achieved. So sometimes how cool it can be both. It can be like, this is really shitty, but this is really awesome. Look at this guy. Like, this dude's Asian. He's crossing over these black dudes and dunking on them. That's fucking awesome. You know what I mean? We have arrived. That's great. Let's celebrate. Anyways, he stops me and he's just like, it is your job to make them understand. No more, no less. That's it. And I'm like, but no buts. Make them understand. So he told a story about the first time he performed in Greenwich Village, 61, 62. Anyways, he talks about he drove there with his friends in Philly. He gets there. He goes up. There's seven people at this show. He bombs. Goes back in the car. They're driving back to Philly. And all his buddies go, Kaz, man, you were funnier in the car. And he was like, it was my mission then to be as funny as I was in the car, to be that funny on stage. It took me a while. But basically that was his thing, is he was like, I needed to find a way to make the audience understand how funny I was in the car. That's it. And if I messed up, if they didn't get it, it's my job to go back and just make them understand, make it palatable. I think Chris Rock is one of the best comedians at that, taking abstract things that people do not care about largely, election, politics.
Right.
And he's able to dissect it in a way. I call people like him and Patrice hood philosophers. He's the guy I would meet on the corner and be like, yo, break this down. Like, what does this mean? Like, I don't understand what the Electoral College is.
Right.
The fuck is that? It's taking complex things and breaking it down so that everybody gets it, making it palatable to you. And so, like, it just changed the way I think of things. So I'm like, all right, I just have to make them understand. I need to put it in terms or through a lens that the audience can understand. Because, dude, I sometimes play the Irvine Improv, and I'm like, they don't get me. They're not going to like me. It's like blonde-haired surfer kids named Cody. They're not gonna like who I am or what I'm about. But when I figured out that rap analogy with going back to Oligar and feeling like the rapper that made it,
yeah,
and then making it rain with Snickers and all that stuff for my cousins, dude, it rips in Irvine. And I'm like, I made them understand. I put a lens on it that way they could see it. That's the trick. I don't know. And I hope I can do that with my whole act. That's probably the best piece of advice that I've got.
Yeah, I mean, if you did it your whole career, then you're going
to... Yeah, make them understand.
You'll be remembered forever, I think.
Second best piece is Aditi was like... She was talking about how hard it was for her to be a girl. She's like, how am I going to get married? There's so many cultural expectations of me, blah, 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 blah. He was like, you're not a victim. And I know that's a very cliche thing, but like... I went back and I just YouTubed him, man. And it's like, he did the Ed Sullivan Show in 66, man. Like, black dudes were getting hosed down in the streets.
Yeah, black people weren't on television.
They weren't on television.
That guy
and
did
he's up
so
there,
much.
He's up there and he's just like, snowball fights. Remember the snow? And I'm like, are you serious?
Yeah.
Now, he has gotten some criticism like, yo, man, were you Uncle Tommen? Like, what's the deal? Like, but at the same time, he's like, no, I'm not going to be a victim or... I'm not going to just play to the box that you're going to put me in. My act, my emotions, my character is going to transcend what you expect of me.
He transcended race. I
exactly,
mean,
man.
One of my dad's favorites. I grew up with Cosby albums. And my dad loved Pryor. It was the yin and yang.
Yeah.
But Cosby was involved in civil rights and in his regular actions. But
sure.
His comedy, he didn't feel the anger to go up there and, I mean, listen to an old Dick Gregory album.
Yeah.
They're not funny. He's talking about
yeah.
political shit of the time.
Yeah.
It's not funny. You listen to it now, you're like, oh, I don't remember who that, I don't that Supreme Court justice was or this lieutenant governor of Alabama.
Yeah.
And you listen to Cosby's shit and it's still, oh my God, I had problems with my brother.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah, man. Why Is There Air? Great album. It's like these are like phenomenal. Oh, dude, it still holds up. Man, and like you know, it was inspiring to see him at 70 whatever, his storytelling. We would be telling stories, he would call back to people, other people's stories. Dude, I don't know a lot of 77 or 78-year-old people that can do that, man.
Yeah.
That's why he's one of the greats. But it's still making me, I'm still reckoning with what he says that you're not a victim, because part of what I do in The Truth is I call shit out and I kind of, on some level, complain about, like, this is wrong. But there's part of me that's like, wait, should I just be above that?
No, what I liked about it was that you are forceful and you're not afraid and you are calling people out on it. No, It's in a real truthful way. It's not it's not in an arrogant, pompous way. You're doing it in like, hey, I'm demanding some social justice here on this fucking issue.
Yeah, I mean,
and that's what I liked about it.
I don't see
enough of it in society and in comedy. Like you're talking about the comedians of Mumbai and Johannesburg. I mean, yeah. I think you're a knight of that cloth.
All right, man.
Yeah,
cool. That was the best comedy advice that I got.
What joke have you written that you're the most proud of?
I have this joke that I close with now that I basically talk about. I feel like it kind of goes like this. Like I feel like the way we see things in America, we feel like we do it the best. But I think we could take a page out of other people's books. Like, for example, stuff like gay rights is such a heated, tumultuous debate. Here in the States, it's like Autobots and Decepticons like against each other. It's just like, should dudes get married? People are like staunchly forward or against it. Places like when I go to India, these notions and these boundaries are just very fluid. Like straight men hold hands in India, and I tell this story about how like whenever I go back and my cousin Sahil, he sees me, he grabs me and he like hugs me and he kisses me, and then, you know, not on the lips, but he'll kiss me and he'll hold my hand. He's like, we're brothers, Hassan. And I'm like, oh my, like, we're in public. We're like in the market. And he's like, come, let's go. And we're holding hands and we're swinging hands and walking through the market. And I talk about it. I'm like, you know, the American part, when he first hugs me, the American part of me is like, whoa, emotional, personal space, stay away, I'm American. But then like once he lets it sit there for like a few seconds, I'm like, this feels great. Like, it's just like, we're both, yeah, we are brothers. Like, we are just kind of one. And we were walking, and in Aligarh, there's this very popular ice cream shop. So we're walking, and we're holding hands, and he's like, let's go get ice cream. We go in, and we walk into this ice cream parlor, and that's where all, like, the cute girls kind of hang out. And he's just like, Hassan, do you like girls? And I'm like, yeah, fucking obviously, you know, we're holding hands, you know? And he's just like, what do you think of that girl over there? And I'm like, yeah, she's cute. And, you know, Sahil, he's really, like, he's talkative. You know, he goes, hey, girl. That's his entry point with the girl. He goes, hey, girl, this is my brother, Hassan, from U.S. Do you want him? Which is like such a great, like what a great setup. You know, thank you for being the wingman of the year, Sahil. You know, and like any girl with dignity, she's like, no. And she walks out and he's just like, fucking lesbian. And then we walked out. Holding hands, sharing an ice cream cone. And I was like, that's how ahead of the curve India is. Two straight men will walk into an ice cream parlor holding hands, call another woman a lesbian, and then walk out and lick a Mars bar together. And so I tell this whole story, and that's one of my favorite jokes to tell. But the message behind it is that, like, there's so much we can all learn about each other that America, we don't have it all figured out, you know?
Fantastic. Hassan, it is great to meet you, brother.
Dude, and, man, thank you for having me.
Thank
man.
You for your truth.
All right.
In closing, do you have any words of wisdom for the, or advice for the people of the world?
Dude, I have no advice. Do you have any advice for me?
No, I think you're killing it, man.
Really?
Yeah, I think you're killing it.
Shit, man.
Keep making those truth videos. They're great. If that stuff doesn't work on stage, the videos are what I thought. I fucking love this guy.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, so cool. I think... you're on the right path, man.
Thank you, man.
And I'm glad you got that show that I was up for.
Dude, I'm glad.
I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
I can't wait to see it.
I'll get you a copy, man. Well, we're still figuring out where it's going to be distributed and stuff like that.
Assalamu alaikum, baby.
Wa alaikum assalam, man.
All right, man. Respect.
Dude, thank you, dude.